Hi, everyone, and welcome to Allocator's Edge, a TVP mini-series where we will be engaging in conversations with the world's top capital allocators. In this ever-changing landscape of heightened inflation and interest rates, we aim to unravel how and why capital allocators make the decisions that they do. Join us as we explore the nuances between healthcare foundations, examining the impact of inflation on endowments, and the strategic choices between share buybacks and dividends for pension schemes. In this mini-series, we aim to shed light on the inner workings of capital allocation, helping both investment teams and listeners gain a better understanding of mandates, global interplay, and the intricate dance between strategy and reality. New episodes of Allocator's Edge will be released on alternating Thursdays, just as we've done with mini-series in the past. This is marketing material for financial professionals and professional clients only. The material is not intended to provide and should not be relied on for accounting, legal, or tax advice or investment recommendations. Reliance should not be placed on any views or information in the material when taking individual investment and or strategic decisions. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. It may not be repeated. Diversification cannot ensure profits or protect against loss of principal. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Exchange rate changes may cause the value of investments to fall as well as rise. Investing in emerging markets and securities with limited liquidity can expose investors to greater risk. Private assets investments are only available to qualified investors who are sophisticated enough to understand the risk associated with these investments. This material may contain forward-looking information such as forecasts or projections. Please note that any such information is not a guarantee of any future performance, and there is no assurance that any forecast or projection will be realized. The views and opinions contained herein are those of the individual to whom they are attributed, and may not necessarily represent views expressed or reflected in any other Schroders communications, strategies, or funds. Any reference to regions, countries, sectors, stocks, or securities is for illustration purposes only, and not a recommendation to buy or sell any financial instruments or adopt a specific investment strategy. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Allocator's Edge on TVP. Today, we're excited to have Sven Lorenz as our guest. Sven is the founder of Sarnia Asset Management. Now, Sarnia will sound familiar to some of our regular listeners of the pod, as one of our guest co-hosts, Harold Berlinica, also works there. Sven also runs the deep value research platform Undervalued Shares and organizes the one-of-a-kind Weird Shit Investing Conference. If you're drawn to unconventional, off-the-beaten-path investing ideas, Sven is the man to know. From litigation finance to biotech to just downright weird assets, Sven uncovers some of the most intriguing, asymmetrical ideas in the market. In this episode, Andrew Williams and Juan will sit down with Sven to discuss Sarnia's objective and what it takes to launch and grow an asset management firm today, how written research can cut through noise in a crowded investment world, the origins of the Weird Shit Investing Conference and what's next for the event, and finally, Andrew Walker's shipping analogy for the active versus passive investment debate. Enjoy.
Sven Lorenz, welcome to the Value Perspective Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here. How are you?
Very well. Thank you, Juan and Andy. Great to be here. Thank you.
So we would like to start our conversation today by asking you to please introduce yourself for the benefit of our audience and walk us through what has been your background and journey so far.
So my name is Sven Lorenz. I'm a lifelong investor in the stock market. I started very early. I think I bought my first stocks when I was either 13 or 14. And to make this a bit more interesting, I can throw out a small anecdote, which also shows how the world changes. So I started investing when insider trading was still legal in my native Germany. And pop quiz question, obviously, you know, when did it change? So that was in the early 1990s. That tells you a bit about the changing standards of society, the changing standards of industries and how they operate. It was a great time to start in the stock market. Things were both easier and more difficult. So I basically started reading magazines that my dad had, which were about the economy and politics, and there was one page with a stock pick in there every month. And that got me interested, and then I started occasionally skipping high school and going to shareholders' meetings instead. I lived in the Frankfurt area, so that was very easy, and my parents, I don't know why, but they somehow accepted me doing that. And I started asking questions at these shareholder meetings, and then occasionally I also rang companies and, you know, asked to speak to one of the directors. And I introduced myself and said, hey, I'm in high school, but I love stocks and I have a few questions. And they were usually quite helpful. And coming back to that anecdote that I started with, so there was also one call to a company at the time called AAA, Real Estate Company. And that chap really liked speaking to me. And then at the end of the conversation, he said, and, you know, don't tell anyone, but in 2 weeks, we're going to announce that we're going to increase our dividend significantly. And it was legal to act on that at the time. Obviously, now everything is quite different. So I've seen a lot.
So how does a boy that grew up very close to the Frankfurt area ended up in the UK and living in an island?
So there are a couple of things in life that I really enjoy and I'm drawn to. One is the English-speaking world, even though I still have my very German accent. I just simply prefer being in an English-speaking environment, which is usually either, you know, Britain or the US. And when I was 15, I was lucky enough to live in the United States for a while and go to high school there. And that was very much a major influence on my life and made it a lot easier for me to say when I was 23, hey, I'm going to move to the UK, I'm going to move to London. That was in 1998. There were a couple of reasons for it. One, I had an ongoing issue with the German military. We still had conscription at the time as well, which, being a bit of a libertarian and not really liking people to tell me what to do, I had a bit of a problem with. There were also some tax considerations, and there was just also simply the desire to live in a major capital in an English-speaking country that also happens to be a major financial capital. And I can't say that I really knew exactly what I was doing back then when I decided, hey, I'm moving to London. But it turned out a great decision. And I'm still, in a way, I'm still here, even though I don't technically speaking live in London, but I'm here every other week.
Well, we're glad you did. Otherwise, we wouldn't have you on our podcast today. So can you talk our listeners through what is Sarnia Asset Management? What does it stand for? And what is your long-term objective?
So as I said, I've been a lifelong stock market guy, and I'm also writing a lot. And basically, my entire career started in the 90s when I started writing for investment newsletters as a freelancer. And then eventually I started publishing on the internet before the word blog was invented. I was already a blogger, and some of my content went viral. And I have always stuck to writing about the market in some shape or form, and that eventually gets you a bit of a following. And to this day, people are asking me, hey, you're always writing these really interesting, you're writing up these interesting investment ideas, but I don't have time to follow all of them. I don't have time to even just read all the stuff that you're writing. Could you not start a fund and I can give you money to manage a fund? To which my answer is that I can't do that quite so easily, because the day only has 24 hours, and in between writing, recording podcasts, meeting interesting people across London, you know, I can't sit in front of a Bloomberg terminal all day and manage a portfolio. That is in itself a job that you need to be very dedicated to. So I ended up sitting down with a couple of friends who were in the finance and fund management industry as well, and we decided, let's set up together a new firm, a fund management firm, where I'm not going to manage the funds, but I'm going to enable people who are brilliant portfolio managers to focus on their job, which is managing a portfolio, and we will create funds for them, or we will market their funds for them. Fundraising, operating a fund manager, dealing with all the compliance stuff, marketing, all of these are jobs that portfolio managers don't really want to do and shouldn't do, because they have to focus on their portfolio. And we set out with Sarnia Asset Management to launch some exciting fund managers and bring them to market and increase the amount of assets they raise.
I want to talk about what it takes to, in your opinion, what it takes to build and be an entrepreneur in the asset management industry today. But before we do that, I want to circle back to your blog. What's the name of the blog? How can people sign to it? How long has it been? What type of investment ideas do you cover?
So people who want to look me up find me on undervaluedshares.com, and the website does what it says on the tin. I've been writing this particular website with one interruption since the late 1990s. There was one period in my life when I lived in South America to do charity work, and that's when I didn't write. But other than that, I've always been publishing on the internet, and I guess I'm probably known for finding slightly off the beaten path ideas and coming up with original independent ideas and thinking. I think that's at least what I'm aiming to do. And there is a free weekly article that I publish every Friday, and that has a bit of a cult following by now, hopefully. And yeah, that's my blog.
And how do you find blogging in a world that seems to be moving away from the written form, as in it seems like it's a little bit crowded sometimes. People are now doing the new version of the blog, which is a Substack. What are your thoughts about that?
So this is a question that I have thought about a lot myself, and I still haven't got a clear answer to it. I can give you two very separate answers. And one is that there's always a place for the written word, and including long form writing. And I write very long and very detailed articles and research reports. And my readers love the website for that very reason. And I have readers who've been reading my work for 25 years, so I'm doing something right. And a lot of my readers do tend to have a lot of assets under management, either personally or for institutions that they work for. On the other hand, I am also entirely open to listen to the counter argument that, in a way, my readership is quite small. So if you can measure your readers in the, you know, in the five digits, that in a way makes you a very, grain in the whatever the right expression is, but basically it makes you a bit of a niche writer, really. And other people with podcasts and on Twitter and people who do YouTube channels have a much larger following. I would always question, is their following the same kind of quality? And I don't have a definitive answer to that. And as you can hear from this, I'm still undecided, and I think there's probably a place for writing, long-form writing, podcasts, videos, all of the above.
That's great. And then I want to go back to the original question, which is all about exploring your thoughts around what does it take to start an asset management business today, in your opinion, and from all of the conversations and engagements that you're having with so many people in the community.
So to set up a new fund management business nowadays as a startup, I think takes a degree of insanity. It takes a lot of money, a very high pain threshold, and you need to be willing to invest several years of your life to figure out how to make it work, basically. I'm dramatizing slightly now, but the barriers to entry are quite high nowadays. Just getting a license to be a fund manager is expensive and can easily cost you a year of your life and a million or two. Of course, there are also other solutions. You can use, as I always call them, an umbrella provider, someone else's regulatory umbrella. And that's perfectly fine in a way to set up a business. The question I would then ask is, do you actually own and control your business if you rely on someone else's license and they can always yank the carpet out from under your feet? Bottom line is, I'd say it's doable. You do need a certain amount of capital, and it's not really quite the kitchen table operation anymore that you used to be able to set up 10, 20 years ago when, you know, two guys could just team up and set up a fund manager. Even in the United States, where the entry barriers for this type of business are a lot lower, even over there, it's becoming quite difficult. Never mind the fact that investors ask, you know, how much AUM do you have under management? Oh, it's only 3 million, you know, like come back when you've raised 100 million, then I can give you money. It's difficult. Then again, you know, doing business and setting up a business is about solving problems and overcoming obstacles. And if it was easy, everyone else would be doing it. So, you know, I think it's doable and people should seriously consider it because we need more entrepreneurs in that space.
It's very interesting here you discuss the challenges because, you know, Sarnia's ethos is really all about finding very, very talented fund managers, but they don't necessarily have access to a consolidated distribution team that can connect them with like-minded capital allocators. So we've heard about the challenges, but there clearly is an opportunity there as well. So do you think we're about to see a renaissance in the boutique asset management model for genuinely differentiated strategies?
I see a lot of interest in that space, and I think that's for a number of reasons, but let's just start with a concrete example, what exactly it is that we're actually speaking about. So I'm currently working on launching one fund that is going to come out imminently that is managed by a gentleman who has an audited real money track record for the last 24 years. He's been managing his own portfolio since the year 2000, and that's a real money portfolio, and the performance was audited. His performance is 24.7% for these 24 years. Comes with a caveat, he started with a small amount of money. That obviously makes it a bit easier, but still, it's an outstanding performance. And then when you break it down, there was never a 3-year, 5-year, or 10-year period when he lost money. So he made money across multiple cycles under very different circumstances. And in a way, his long-term performance is in a you could say it's a bit understated, because most fund managers start measuring their performance, or the performance they use in their marketing is picked very carefully to coincide with a low in the market. And this gentleman started his performance in the year 2000 when markets were at a high. So, you know, he could have just picked 2001 and that would have made him look a lot better. The thing is, he's managing a very small amount of money. And this goes back to the reason why we set up this business. Being a very good portfolio manager and having an outstanding track record doesn't mean that people come knocking on your door begging you to give you money to manage. You still need marketing. You need the entire operational structure around you so that you can pass the operational due diligence that sophisticated investors will ask for. And that's something we're going to provide. And to come back to your question after this little detour, which I think frames the entire idea and the answer to your question. There is always, I believe, interest in managers who have very original ideas, who are independent thinkers, and who are offering either uncorrelated returns or investments and ideas that are simply not in other portfolios that you can find in the market. And my job and my passion and hopefully one of my strengths is to find these people and to identify them and then to also work with them to bring them to a wider audience. And I think for that, there will always be a market. There has always been a market. It's just not an easy thing to do.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but from our previous conversation that we had, you explained how the idea behind Sarnia is relatively new. Is that correct? What has been the feedback so far when you have tried to match these uncover very well regarded fund managers with different capital allocators?
So my experience is very much focused on speaking to high net worth investors. So our company has, in a way, as its ethos and its focus, to focus on what we call, and don't laugh, but we call them the poor millionaires. With that, we mean people who have between 1 million and 20 million in investable assets. So people who are wealthy and successful, but they're not wealthy enough to have their own family office or to go to one of the famous and, you know, visible multifamily offices. They probably also wouldn't get a meeting with one of the hedge fund managers in Mayfair. So they're a bit stuck in the middle. They can't go to their high street bank anymore for investment advice and to get good investment ideas. They usually have built a business which created their wealth. So they are ambitious, they're entrepreneurial, they want to get to the next level. If you have 5 million, you want to get to 10 million. Once you have 10 million, you want to get to 20 million. And the guy who has 20 million wants to get to 100 million. So they're looking for investments that also have the potential, at least, to outperform and generate significant returns in alpha. And among that clientele, I find there's tremendous interest in what we're just getting off the ground. Among capital allocators, first of all, I don't speak to that many of them. And secondly, the large capital allocators, as you will know, have all become quite institutional. And from their perspective, we might be a bit too colorful, a bit too quirky, a bit too small in any case. So let's just say we'll focus on the high net worth individuals and smaller family offices. And that's where we have a lot of interest.
From all of those interactions, from all of the work that you've done with the blog, from Sarnia, you came up with this idea over the summer. Actually, I don't know how long ago did you thought about what I'm going to ask you. So that would be really interesting to know. But you launched during the summer the Weird Shit Conference. Now, we don't usually edit anything. So we are going to name the name, but for the purpose of avoiding some issues with our compliance, we're going to refer to it as the WSC, which I think it's fine, right? And you did that in both London and New York. So how did the Weird Shit Conference came about?
So I have to give a reader from New York credit for that event. As I said, I have a blog, I have a large readership around the world, and I travel a lot. And I have this habit of, when I travel to a place where a decent amount of my readers reside, New York being one of these places. I send out an email and I say, hey, I'm in New York. Anyone wants to go for a drink, meet up, talk about markets and ideas? And I did that last year when I was on the East Coast. And in New York, one of my readers, who shall remain unnamed, but he's a very sophisticated investor, specialized in litigation investing. So, you know, something weird. He said, oh, Sven, you always come up with these weird ideas, you know, and you could call it weird beep. And why don't you organize a conference or get together to talk just about that? And 2 days later, I told another fund manager friend in Florida about this idea. And he said, this is amazing. Let's do this. I'm in. I'll help. And then we talked about, shall we do this in London? Shall we do it in New York? And I said, well, to make it easy and to get this off the ground, why don't we do it in London first on a Tuesday? And then on Wednesday, I fly over to New York. And then we do it on Thursday in New York. So it was what I called a bi-continental conference. And the concept was very much one of, you have to convince me why you should be invited to that conference. We wanted to have people who have weird, original, unusual investment ideas and could present them in 20 minutes. And it was basically an ideas contest, a bit like the Sohn conference, but a bit more, yeah, off the beaten path, a bit more original. And it was a great success. And oh yeah, one thing I made all the participants do was to commit to providing a one-page summary of their investment idea, of their pitch, in a specific format, because I wanted to publish that. So we put together the weird beep investment manual, and we published that for free on the internet so that everyone who couldn't come to the actual event benefited from it and could look through all these investment ideas. And I think it was close to 40. It's still on the internet. It's a great document to go through. There's some really good ideas in there.
So actually, you can find the document on your website.
Correct, on undervaluedshares.com.
And I know for a fact that it's been making the rounds, at least in the city of London. It dropped on my WhatsApp at least 3 times from different sources. So it did create a buzz. I think one of the things that you didn't mention is that you tried to keep the conference quite small to a very limited number of people. And I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, the initial number was going to be 20 in London, I don't know how many in New York, but then it created such a buzz that you had to open it to more people. So what was that like?
So I like to experiment with events, and this year with the inaugural edition of that conference, I said, okay, in London, let's make it a bit bigger because we had so much demand. In London, we had 20 people presenting and another 22 attending, as we called them, voyeurs. So they were mostly capital allocators and other investors. So 42. And then in New York, we had 22, 6 team of whom presented, and another 6 were family offices and investors. And in retrospect, I have to say New York worked a bit better because every participant could meet easily all the other participants. Once you go past 25 with a crowd, it becomes a bit more difficult to manage. So I think we're going to keep it small again next year. Next year, my ambition is to organize it in Hong Kong, London, and New York, because I have a lot of interest for that in Asia as well. And the idea is to do it in Hong Kong on the Thursday, London Tuesday, New York on Thursday, and then the day after that, publish the manual with all the ideas. It's ambitious, but it's great fun as well for me. And very much one of the ideas is also to enable everyone to meet like-minded individuals and fellow professional investors that otherwise they would have never met. Because a lot of the people who read my blog and come to these events are, you could say, invisible, off the radar. They are often either private investors or fund managers who work in a bit of a niche. And where do you go to meet them if you're in that industry? And I've created a venue now for them to get to know each other. And the networking coming out of this has been tremendous. And in fact, after we're recording this podcast, I'm going to a private members club in London where I've organized a get together of veterans of that conference to discuss ideas tonight.
I'm going to ask you a very unfair question, which came from some of the discussions that we have in the past. But for compliance reasons, I cannot really ask you to name the ideas that came during the conference that caught your attention. So the unfair question is going to be, what sort of ideas came out, without naming names, that actually you thought were quirky enough and really interesting off path from either the event in London or New York?
So to speak very broadly and speak more about sectors and, you know, to keep it general enough to make it pass compliance, one very interesting ideas were non-performing loans from Greece, which are actually quite easy to trade on the Athens Stock Exchange if you know where to look. It's just that no one ever looks at these things. There was one presentation about a niche area of the insurance market relating to Lloyd's of London. Lloyd's of London obviously being a marketplace rather than a company. And within that marketplace, there are many ways how to go about writing insurances or benefiting from the insurance industry. And there was one particularly quirky idea in that sector. And something that has just proven tremendously popular, even though it's very controversial, is any way how to invest or how to get exposure to Russian equities. That's a bit of a evergreen, for lack of a better word. There is tremendous interest in that whole idea.
So I was going to ask you if the ideas were only equities, but you have actually answered that question. And then the other thing that you are very good at is in connecting people and organizing events, not only the conference itself, but I've seen that if there's someone interesting, an interesting investor coming from the US, you will reach out to your network people, you say who's interested, and you will gather them in a room to exchange ideas. How does that go about?
So I guess I'm a bit of a natural connector between people. I just enjoy bringing people together. And I do this in a, I would say, non-commercial way, in the sense that I don't organize conferences to sell expensive tickets. I always organize events on the basis of I want to have the costs covered. Everyone pays their fair share. And for example, with dinners, we always say, you know, we just split the bill through the number of participants at the end of the evening. And I believe that in life, a lot of good things happen to you if you know a lot of people, and you shouldn't network with a particular agenda. That never works. No one wants to be networked with because you want to get something out of them there and then. People like meeting like-minded people, and everyone believes that, yes, it's useful to have a lot of professional contacts as well, but everyone also likes to have a bit of fun, likes to go for a drink or a meal with people who are with whom you can have a bit of a memorable evening or a memorable lunch. And that's really all there is. And once you've started doing that, in a way, it just perpetuates without much effort, because once you know a critical mass of people, it's always easy to pull together a few sort of like known contenders and then add a few new faces to it. And there's obviously LinkedIn nowadays. Even if you don't write a blog, you know, there's no excuse not to actively network and occasionally also publish something and share your knowledge. That's what LinkedIn is for. And LinkedIn is a real a gift to, let's say, at least the finance industry, if not even humanity, one of the few sane social networks, if you want to put it like that. So yeah, it's just something I do on the side. I don't even think about it.
Which is a great segue to my next question, which comes from the fact that before we met, I saw, I was already following you on LinkedIn, and I saw that you had attended the Sun Conference in New York, and you actually mentioned that from your experience, Americans were better at organizing events, making stock pitches, and networking. So I wanted to ask you, what do you think are the main differences today in the investment landscape among the US, Europe, and Asia?
Well, it's a very broad question, but I mean, let's start with the obvious fact. As a good friend of mine always says, Americans have more money than God. There is so much capital in the United States. It is just unbelievable. And New York is obviously the epicenter of that. And I'm staunchly pro-American. I lived over there. I think it's literally the greatest country on earth in many ways, despite all its obvious flaws. And it attracts a lot of talent from all over the world, and it's very competitive. I mean, speak of New York being competitive. So when you have something like the Sohn Conference in New York, that's obviously a meeting place of the brightest minds and a lot of very large allocators. And I don't know if you've ever noticed, when you go to the United States, everyone's very chatty and very friendly. I mean, you go to a restaurant and the waitress is like, hey, I'm Natasha, I'm going to be your waiter tonight. Everyone introduces themselves. You go into an elevator and people say, oh, hi, where you're from? You know, and you have like a 7-second conversation with them and you find out where they're from. And I think this just permeates through the business world in the States as well. People are just naturally more easy to open a conversation with. They're also very business-minded. They get down to business very quickly, make quick decisions. They're more focused. If you wanted to put it in a negative way, you could say that in London, you meet for a business lunch and you drink wine together and it's a 2.5 hour affair and no business is actually done. And in the United States, you meet for a sandwich and a Diet Coke. And if you're lucky, you get a pack of crisps as well. But, you know, you walk out of a meeting and you've done some business. I don't know if that really gets to the heart of your question. The difference in the investment landscape is something I notice in my peer group, which is the high net worths and the family offices. It's that over there, so many investors have so much exposure to private investments nowadays. And me being a stock market guy, I find that obviously very difficult to get my head around. And investing into private investments was something when I grew up, that was an odd thing to do. It was all about the stock market. And now it's sort of the other way around. You're the odd guy if you're in the stock market. But I think that'll have a renaissance because, I mean, we've just been through, 16 years without a recession or however long that's been. And eventually there'll be a bad time again in markets. And then to be able to actually get out of investments and just press a button and sell, I think that will prove very useful. And if you have private investments, you can't sell. That's having lived through multiple cycles, why would I buy something where I can't just hit a button and sell? That's very alien to me. And that's a big difference between what I've seen in the United States and what I'm seeing over here. But everyone has their limited universe, so it's a very biased view.
And you have also mentioned that the WSC conference next year, what you want to achieve is have the event in London first, then go to New York, then actually do it in Hong Kong. And you believe that there is a wide audience in Asia very interested in that. And I'm a little bit curious about why do you think that that's the case? If that's because you've seen the demand up front, people reaching out to you, or how is that idea coming about?
So I have some thoughts on that, but I have to put a disclaimer first. I know very little about Asia. And in a way, my number one reference point in Asia is Hong Kong, where I've spent a lot of time in the past. And I once was a director of a property fund over there in Macau. But Asia is obviously very big and very diverse. And I really am not going to hold myself out as the Asia expert here. But having said that, I went to Hong Kong for the first time in 5 years earlier this year. And again, I just sent out an email to my readers and I said, is there someone in Hong Kong who wants to come along and meet publicly listed companies in Hong Kong? And I thought, well, if three or four people come together, that'd be great. And I think in the end, we were 16 or something like that. Great group of people. Five of them flew over from Singapore. There was someone from Taiwan as well. And I met a lot of very dedicated small and mid-cap investors, value investors who were eager to explore what I would describe as the less trodden paths of the Asian capital markets. And there is not enough of a scene over there for blogs, conferences, places and events where you can find slightly more alternative and original ideas. And I just found it a very fertile ground to put myself out there and say, hey, I'm organizing something. And all sorts of amazing people came out of the woodwork and said, hey, I'm coming and, you know, let's join forces. So I'll do that again. It's a bit of an experiment, but there's certainly demand.
I hope our listeners are now getting a sense that you're very keen to speak to investors that don't necessarily fit into a well-defined bucket, or certainly outside of the buckets which the industry or a consultant would like to put us in. I was going to say misfits, which sounds slightly rude, but hopefully I mean that in a positive way.
And you'll be surprised to hear I actually have a WhatsApp group. That's my dinner group here in London, who are called Misfits and Iconoclasts. So you're spot on. We are the Misfits.
Oh, brilliant. I'm glad I didn't cause offense then. What that means is, though, is you talk to a very broad range of very different investors with very different and very independent views is the way I characterize it. We've touched a little bit on this, talking about private markets versus public and things, but what are you hearing from the investors you're talking to about the state of the markets today? And that can be, you know, active versus passive, the state of price discovery in stock markets today, or dare I say even the future of value investing, which is obviously something that's very close to our hearts.
Yes, so I'd start at the back. The value investors are obviously all a bit depressed because value investing has been, let's say, somewhat out of fashion for a long time now. And everyone is running towards the Mag 7 and the large index trackers, et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, I mean, all of this has happened before. And at the end of the day, markets price future cash flows. And right now, I think more than at any time in the last, really since the great financial crisis, there are amazing companies out there in the small and mid-cap space, especially in Europe, especially trading at valuations where you just have to say, if you buy into this with a 3 or 5 or 10 year horizon, there's just no way you can't not make money. And the level of depression and frustration that's out there, especially among value investors, when it comes to issues such as price discovery, I think the pain is so big right now that it's probably a great time to allocate some capital. And this is what I found when I spoke at a conference of high net worths in the United States in Washington last month. They were all heavily invested in real estate and in private investments, private equity and venture capital. And when I showed them some of the examples of what you can currently find in public markets, and you don't even have to buy anything exotic, there are a lot of world-leading companies out there with significant market cap and certainly enough liquidity for a private investor to comfortably get in and out, I think that's a bit of a no-brainer. So, I have full confidence in the perception of that particular part of the market changing again, and our fortunes in that space, you know, being in for a bit of a renaissance.
And any thoughts or things that you're hearing on active versus passive? And I know it's almost a trite question, but I think still quite pertinent given the concentration we're seeing in global benchmarks in particular.
Well, my answer might surprise you a little bit, because you'd probably expect me to get up on a soapbox and, you know, preach about the virtues of active investing. But actually, since the late 1990s, whenever friends and family members ask me about, you know, where should I invest money? Because people obviously ask me that question. And whenever it comes from people who are not full-time professional investors, I've always not wanted to have the responsibility of actually giving them, you know, informal advice at family events and, you know, in social circles. And since the late 1990s, I've always told them, you know, just put it into an index fund, save, minimize your taxes, maximize how much money you can save, and put it away, because in the long run, the world gets richer and economies grow. And with an index fund, you can't really do much damage. And for most people, I think that's the right thing. At the same time, for people who may be wealthier, may have a more active interest in the subject, and who have made money on the back of entrepreneurial activities and want to invest into something that can make them get ahead faster, I think active investing is the only place to go. I think there's not even a discussion about that.
Which also leads me to my next question. We had Andrew Walker on this podcast a few weeks ago. And I don't know if you've heard his podcast. It's called Yet Another Value Podcast. And he also has a Substack/blog that goes by the same name. And he wrote this piece that caught my attention, because he was commenting, well, he was actually quite annoyed by the paper that Cliff Asner's team had wrote about, making the claim that markets had become less efficient rather than more efficient. And Andrew was a little bit annoyed, because he was going through the thought process of saying, well, if that's the case, then it would be easy for active management to outperform, which doesn't seem to have been the case over the last few years. But then what caught my attention, and this is where the question is leading, is about a comparison that he made between the shipping industry and the active management industry. And what he was saying was that maybe active management, and I think that he was making a reference to value active management, was becoming very similar to the shipping industry cycle, where everyone knows that in shipping you have losses for 9 years, and then in 1 year you recoup all of your losses of the previous 9 years, and actually you make the profit. And what he was referring to is that, could there be the case that active management is actually coming like that, and maybe value active management like that? And so I just wanted to poke your thoughts around this analogy and what you think will be the future of active management.
It's probably not a bad analogy. It might be a bit too extreme. I mean, shipping is so extremely cyclical. I can't really see the active management industry or the value investing industry going quite that way. But it's a good analogy for fund management business in general. I mean, every let's say every 7 years or maybe every 10 years, there's just that one outlier year where a fund manager really outperforms because somehow you just hit your stride and something that you've been waiting for finally works out. And then they generate large amounts of capital. And that obviously then sometimes gets into the news if it's a large enough fund manager to, you know, make it into the news. And that might make it appear like there's easy money to be had or they're making money on the back of their investors. But really what it is all about is performance fees. I'm a big believer in performance fees. Management fees really should pay primarily for keeping the lights on and enabling a new manager to enter the fund management industry in the first place. And then there has to be alignment between the investor and the fund manager. And if there's an outlier year, then of course that should be an outlier year for the manager as well. So that's where that analogy is a good one. And that's why people, for example, like myself, enter the fund management industry, because you have that prospect of hitting such an outlier year. But I don't think it's quite as extreme as in the shipping industry. That's probably the most extreme industry that I've come across in this regard. And I hope the fund management industry is not going that way.
I think diving into performance fees and the merit of those, I think, in eating some of your own cooking, etc., is a whole other podcast. But certainly that alignment between investor and investee is something that's very important and something we could certainly dig into more. But I'm very conscious of your time. You've been extremely generous with it. And thank you so much for coming to visit us here in London. That's been fantastic. Now, but before we let you go, we ask all of our guests a signature question. And that is for a book recommendation for our listeners. Can be anything you like from kind of antiquity onwards. So Sven, what would you like our investors, what would you like to recommend, I should say, to all of our listeners?
Okay, so obviously I can't recommend an investment book because that would be just too obvious and a bit too boring. I'd like to recommend an author and two books that he's written. We've spoken a lot about original ideas and, you know, different ways of thinking and being a bit of a misfit. And someone I very much enjoy following is a guy called Scott Adams, who's well known for being the creator of Dilbert, who has become a, let's say, public intellectual, political commentator, very broad kind of YouTube and Substack and Twitter content creator, for lack of a better word. And what I really like about Scott Adams is that he comes up with genuinely different ways of looking at things, which could be politics, the economy, sometimes financial markets as well. He even did once speak about one particular stock that he invested in. So it's also sometimes very directly relevant. And he has a Twitter account with 1 million followers. And he's written two books, one of which I have just recently read and one of which I read a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago, he published How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big. I love that book and I've been giving it away as gifts to mostly younger friends as well. And then recently he's published Reframe Your Brain, The User Interface for Happiness and Success. And it sounds a bit like a self-help book, but I think it's a great tool for developing and sharpening your mind and your ability to come up with ideas that other people have not yet come up with. That's really at the core of it, because if you want to have outlier years of success in financial markets, you need to be ahead of your time and to come up with ideas that other people haven't had yet. And I think Scott Adams teaches you to some extent how to do that.
Well, they both sound like very interesting reads. I'll add them to the reading list and we'll be sure to link to them in the show notes as well. But Sven, thank you very much for coming on the Value Perspective podcast, and we hope to have you back one day.
Thanks, Andy. Thanks, Juan. It was an absolute pleasure.